You're not sick, Amelia, no.
No?
No, you're a little farsighted.
This is the Farsighted Network.
This is the Farsighted Network.
This is the Farsighted Network.
Thanks for listening.
Enjoy the show.
September 29th, in the final confrontation with Michael Myers, the secret of his evil will be revealed. Halloween, the curse of Michael Myers, rated R, starts Friday, September 29th.
Welcome to the PS Midnight Cast.
The show where we're only chasing nostalgia.
And where darkness comes to die.
I'm your host, Riff Daddy.
I'm your other host, Captain Nostalgia. Let me ask you something, man. Why do you always pause in the beginning of when you introduce yourself? Do you forget who you are for a few minutes?
No, I have a knack of talking too fast, so I have to stop and make sure I get it out really clear. And I mumble sometimes, and like, you know. I mean, I'm only like a year and a few months into podcasting, so I gotta learn how to talk. I just not learn how to read, so.
Yeah, sometimes I still like mess up when I read, and I was recording an episode of Victims last night that when we're recording this is the Predator episode. But, like, I was, like, going back over my notes and, like, I was, like, stumbling over my words trying to articulate them. So, like, as my co-host was talking, like, I was trying to, like, paraphrase, like, in my head, trying to, like, both listen and prepare myself to read aloud. I don't know why. Like, reading to me out loud sometimes still messes me up, which is weird because I'm a teacher, so.
You're a teacher?
Yeah, man. When I get to teach people, I'm not like a teacher, but when I get to teach people about, you know, God and whatnot. And...
If you were a teacher, would they call you Mr. Nostalgia?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And it's like,
either that or Captain.
Hey, Captain. And, like, if they want your attention, instead of raising their hand, they have to, like, put their hands out like Superman.
Man, if I was a teacher, my kids would be, my classroom would be a lot like Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams class. Like,
yeah.
At the end, I would get fired, and they would all stand on their desks and say, "Oh, Captain, my Captain."
It's a good movie, man.
When Eric and I first got married, she had never seen it, and
oh, wow.
I showed it to her. I was like, "This is probably one of Robin Williams' best performances." And I forgot how dark it was with the kid at the end where he kills himself. And
yeah.
I was like, well, definitely forgot about that.
Yeah, a few years ago at 2911, the church that I'm a part of again, we would do a young adult small group. And one Sunday, the guy that led it, Kyle, the young adult pastor, I think he's just a pastor now, but that was his title then. He came in like, "All right, guys, today I'm going to do things a little different. I'm going to teach y'all something that y'all might not really understand from the Bible. You can just call me Mr. Keaty." And, like, no one knew what he was referring to but me. He was so upset. Like, he even considered, he was like, "Guys, I might just take Brandon outside to the back porch, and y'all can just stay in here and think about what y'all done." Like, he was so upset. Like, there was like 15 young adults in there, and only one of them knew what he was talking about.
That's awesome. I do that all the time. Like, I'll be at work, and like, I'll just drop a random movie quote that'll fit perfectly into the conversation that's being had, and nobody will get that. 9 times out of 10, it's something from like the early 2000s. I quote a lot of Mean Girls, and no one understands the references. And
oh, man.
I love it.
I just remembered he was like, "Show of hands. Who here are movie buffs? Everyone like raised their hand. He was like, "Huh, y'all just lied at the Bible study. How dare y'all? I've never seen Dead Poets Society."
Oh, man. Dead Poets Society.
Oh, man.
It's very much underrated movie. And did you ever see a couple years ago, Fred Armisen made his way back to Saturday Night Live, and they did a sketch that was very similar to the very last scene of Dead Poets Society, where they all stood on their desks.
No, I did not see that. I heard about it. I didn't see it, though.
I'll have to find it and send it to you after we get done tonight. Like, it is... I can't tell to you because, like, the joke of the whole thing is the ending. Like, it's very dry, and then there's just this punchline that you just watch. And every time I watch it, Eric and I just watched it again a couple weeks back, and I was literally crying. Like, I've seen it, like, 4 or 5 times, and I was just crying laughing so much.
Yeah. I'll check it out. Oh, almost burped. Oh, that would have been bad.
It would have been bad.
Drink a lot of sweet tea today.
I'm actually drinking tea as we record right now.
But it's not sweet tea.
It's hot tea.
You northerner.
Man, it's a little chilly up here. I'm not gonna lie.
Dude, the first day of fall is next week, and it's like it was 91 degrees today. So
that's... But that's Alabama. That's stuff that you guys are used to. Like, I'm the kind of guy that if I stand in front of a fridge for too long, I will walk away, go grab a hoodie, and come back.
Dude, I hang out in the big freezer sometimes at work, the lunchroom.
So weird.
Yeah.
I guess it's just different. Dude, I've always been that way. Like, hoodies for me, like... They go literally all year round. Like, I sleep with a comforter all year round.
Oh, yeah, I do that. I have to get really cold and bundle up.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, I've always been like that. And it's weird because, like, Erica's, like, that's how Erica's exactly like where you are. Like, she gets really hot easily. And so it's really weird, like, when we, like, sleep in bed because, like, she's like next to nothing like blanket wise and I'm just like I got a hoodie, I'm bundled up, I got like 4 or 5 like 3 or 4 blankets, like it's so weird, so diverse in my marriage.
Rocking the Iron Man shirt tonight. I see
I am rocking an Iron Man shirt, an Under Oath hat.
Oh wow.
Yeah, they got this at their reunion tour a couple years ago. It was I didn't not like any of the shirts that they had, and I saw this and I was like, $20, $25, something like that. I was like, it's a good deal. I like that era of Under Oath. So,
you know, the best shirt they ever made was that really really old shirt you bought Hot Topic. It had like the pink X and had Under Oath on it. That's like that shirt's so cool to me,
dude. It's like. I was Eric and I were watching Teen Titans last night, and like Teen Titan, like it's the there was an episode. Did you ever watch Teen Titans growing up?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Did you ever see the? Do you remember the episode where the Puppet King comes and he makes these like marionette versions of the team, and then switches their bodies?
Yeah. The girls. Yeah, and, I didn't
like,
remember that.
He's like little controller to control them. Reminded me so much of that. Like, I was watching that last night, and I was just thinking about that shirt, and I was like, that looks a little bit like that Under Oath shirt now that Brent's talking about it.
Yeah, they'll always, like, reprint it, but then, like, it goes so fast, I don't get to get it. I'm like, ugh.
And they jacked up the prices. It's like $30 now every time they release it.
They know people want it, so they're like, well, if you want it, you gotta pay, like, an arm and a leg to get it.
I mean, you could always eBay it, like get it like first gen.
I've actually considered it, like just getting a press, just making shirts for myself.
It's expensive.
Yeah, I've considered that, but yeah,
that's a hobby to get into.
I would definitely extend my limit if I did that.
But I mean, speaking of music, we are so this is our second season, and we've been talking about it for a while. But this is our third episode in the second season, and we have a new theme song. So this was something that you actually set up for the show, bro.
Yeah. So one of my good friends, been a friend of mine for a long time, Tim. He does music under the name Carlisle Jones Hip Hop, he does a lot of his last album he put out. Go check it out. It's called Channel 46, and it is literally 2000s Cartoon Network. This he's just relating like old cartoons to his real life, and it's so good. And so yeah, today I was like, hey man, we want a new song. Can you do something for us? And he literally whipped it up in like 20 minutes. Like, he really did.
When we were talking about it this morning, I was like, okay, like I'm expecting to like get off and listen to this song that you wanted to use originally for it, not the one that we went with. And he was like, oh no, he can make us something brand new. And I was like, that's up to you, man. Like whatever goes. And I laid my phone down, and like 20 minutes later, I get an email from you, and I'm like, well, that was fast.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Him and my buddy Hayden and Zach, they just launched a new podcast called the Mochi Mochi Podcast. I said Mochi. And that's just three dudes just like cutting up, just talking, telling stories. If you're into like stories of like talking about like old video games, anime, old cartoons, or a story about our friend Phil driving from Alabama to Washington, D.C. to buy an old TV, you should check the podcast out. So shout out to those dudes, and thanks, Tim, for hooking up us with some new music. And check out Tim's music, Carlisle Jones. It's everywhere. Spotify, Bandcamp, iTunes, everywhere.
So we'll have links for all of Tim's stuff in the links below for this episode. But I don't know, man. I feel like the subject of their show, if you guys haven't listened to this, maybe let's do a crossover. Just saying.
Yeah.
Your show fits perfect with ours.
Yeah, let's do it. Because those dudes love 2000s cartoons and stuff just like we do. So maybe we could hook something up. That'd be a lot of fun.
Maybe like a special season finale kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know, and our buddy Phil, he comes on time to time on the show. Like, he has a really good impression of Sora and Goofy from Kingdom Hearts, and it's incredible. So, y'all should definitely hear that. Maybe we can get a Goofy and Elmo interview.
Elmo's here? Huh? What?
That'd be something.
Elmo's always here. Spirit, Elmo's really the producer of show, so.
Yeah. Elmo's something. I tried tickling him the other day, and he didn't like it too much. I think he's over that.
Elmo bites people now.
Whoa.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Elmo, man, I mean, like the talent search for a co-host for the PS Midnight Cast was exhausting. Man, I think we probably interviewed close to like 300 people, and Brandon was just the one that we went with. Like, there was just an energy about him that.
Yeah. Oh, I was trying to talk, and like acid reflux was like not letting me talk.
It's all good.
I have a lot of old man problems. I'm only 26.
That's all right. I have a lot of old man problems. I'm only 27.
Yeah.
So. Speaking of old and men,
I gotta tell you something.
Go for it.
I saw an article today that said the Halloween Resurrection is like the worst movie ever.
No, I'm sure that there is worse movies out there. It's bad, but it's not like I wouldn't say worst movie. We're actually here talking about a critically terrible movie. But let's see if we both think it's a terrible movie. We are here today talking about The Curse of Michael Myers, the sixth installment into the Halloween franchise. And this is part of the Victims and Villains universe of crossovers, doing all 10 Halloween in anticipation for the upcoming Halloween. This is that we are calling it Haddonfield Homecoming, and so glad to have PS Midnight Cast a part of this. But this is actually a significant film because this marks the final cinematic performance of Donald Pleasant as Dr. Sam Loomis and the first ever starring role of Paul Rudd in a feature film.
Hey, so the dude that played the doctor, is he dead or something? I don't know nothing about the guy, really.
So he's actually a very well trained actor. He played Dr. Sam Loomis. He played him in the original Halloween, Halloween 2. Halloween 3 had nothing to do with Michael Myers, so wasn't in it. But he came back for 4 or 5, and then he died 8 months before the release of this film.
Okay. I was wondering, because you said it was his last movie as that role, so I never really looked the dude up. Because I didn't know nothing about him.
Well, I've never seen him. Like, I've never seen anything outside of Loomis. So, like, to me, like, when you say Donald Pleasant, like, Donald Pleasant's, like, my immediate reaction goes to Halloween because that's the only role I've ever seen him in. But, like, I was watching, like, some, like, behind-the-scenes stuff of, like, Halloween on the Blu-ray that I got. And, like, they were talking about how, just, like, how they wanted to have this, like, balance of, like, introducing someone new in Jamie Lee Curtis, but also at the same time, like, having this, like, super distinguished actor, and, like, he apparently is, like, an Oscar winner. He did, like, a lot of Westerns back in the day, so he's a seasoned actor that went on to go kind of play this role, and it just kind of stuck with him. I'm really not too sure why he continuously went after the Halloween movies, because by critical standpoint, they're not great movies, and here is an actor of high caliber, so I'm not really too sure why he went with these. I don't know if it was just kind of like he was in his De Niro years where he was just doing movies just to do them, or if he genuinely liked this character and just found him compelling.
Well, I mean, I definitely... I've always liked the character. I was raised on Halloween, Friday the 13th, and Nightmare on Elm Street. And I've always, like, that was, like, the three, like, franchise of slashers that my uncle raised me on, and I always liked that character a lot. I thought he was really cool.
Yeah, I really like Sam Loomis, and, like, fun fact, I don't know if you knew this or not, but John Carpenter actually has the name Sam Loomis because of a character out of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. It's a the character is named after the Psycho character as an homage to Hitchcock.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I've never actually watched or listened or watched or read American Psycho or anything, so
I don't know about it. Just Psycho. It's like American Psycho is a whole different ballgame.
Oh, that's what I meant to say with Psycho. That's my bad.
That's all good. All good.
When I think Psycho, I think of that because I know that's like a very like recent thing.
Yeah. I still have yet to actually see American Psycho. It's like on my list of things like I want to eventually watch, but just never have gotten around to it yet.
Yeah. There's a lot of movies like that.
Too. Yeah. So this is like, all right. So there's a lot of information that's actually really interesting about this particular installment into the franchise. This is often one of the more forgotten films in the franchise. A lot of people kind of overlook this, the middle three. So you have 4, 5, and 6. A lot of people overlook these and they just kind of go to 1, 2, 3, H2O, and then Rob Zombie. Resurrection, again, often overlooked. Or if it's remembered, it's remembered for being incredibly bad. You can hear us talk about it with the Fear of God podcast over Victims and Villains. But I'm going to give you this window. Go ahead and get your Busta Rhymes justice out. For Halloween Resurrection before I start.
How'd you know that I was going to say something about Busta Rhymes?
Because I mentioned Halloween Resurrection. And we were just talking about it yesterday.
So my memory with that movie was watching the episode of WWF SmackDown, and The Rock came out, and he was like, "Yo, Busta Rhymes in the house." Busta Rhymes comes into the ring from the crowd, and he's like, The Rock's like, "Yeah, man, so what you been going on, man? You got these albums, you got a movie coming out." And then The Rock was like, "So I gotta ask a question. You know, you're a brother. do you die first in this movie? Do you die at all? This Ryan goes, heck no, I don't die. He's like, I want to whip Michael Myers. Like, it was great. And then I saw the movie because Busta Rhymes.
Man, I had like, and I'm not gonna spoil it. Like, I had really fond memories of that film growing up, because I was younger and I'd only seen it a couple times, and it was one of like the first like modern day to me horror films that I had seen. And going back and rewatching it recently, like, can to say that it is terrible is an understatement. You guys can, I'm not going to say any more than that, because I want you to tune into Victims and Villains.
Well, trick or treat, never mind.
Yeah, we don't say that word on here.
Busta Rhymes is taking me over.
Well, no. No.
Well, respect for Busta Rhymes. He tried his best, and
he did.
I will fight. I won't fight for maybe, but I'll fight for him. I'll stand protection for Busta Rhymes.
All right. So this film has a really weird road to the screen. And so essentially, like, I don't know if you've ever seen Halloween 4.
I've seen them all with Michael Myers. Yeah, okay, so I've seen them all with vaguely.
Like, we talked about the return of Michael Myers with gut reactions on Victims and Villains, but like, you had Halloween 4 come out in 88, and then 89 you had Halloween 5. And so like, the reaction for that was like really, really not enthusiastic, because they pretty much were like 1-2. Like, if you look at the Nightmare on Elm Street films, they're not the greatest films because they were coming out so close to each other. So there really wasn't a lot of time for these things to breathe and develop. And that was a lot of the beginning problems of this film, was that the producer, who has been on part of every Halloween film, and I'm going to butcher his name, but it's Mustafa Fa'a Akada. I really, really, really butchered that name. I'm so sorry. So I'm just going to call him Mr. A. He put the series on hold to kind of rethink the direction that they wanted to go in. He really wanted to kind of get back to the heart of this series, because they felt like the last film really strayed away. And the fifth film is incredibly boring.
I could say the same for this one.
Oh, we're going to get there. We are going to get there. Trust me. All right, so in 1990, all right, so like, once they kind of had this like direction that they wanted to settle, they had to again kind of go through more problems with the legal system, because they were fighting over the rights of where the studios were, and eventually it and wound up going to Miramax's Dimension Films division, and they brought in just screenwriter after screenwriter after screenwriter in June. The film is set to begin production in October, November of that year. So like, they're bringing in all of these screenwriters, and so this guy that they eventually bring on, whose name I can't actually remember at the time, his name is Daniel Ferrance. He got brought on. He had this like vision to bridge the second and the fourth and fifth film with the first and second film. So it was going to be kind of like this complete storyline, but also set up for new installments that were going to revitalize the franchise. And so, yeah, so in the, like, as boring as it was, like, there's interesting aspects of the fifth film, that they had this Curse of Thorn plot, which Jamie which is kind of what we see in the opening for this film, in which Jamie Lloyd is kidnapped by her by a covert cult who has cursed Michael Myers via the runic symbol of Thorn, which compels him to kill and also affords him immortality. So it's just weird. But originally, yeah. wait for it, because originally the original vision for the film had Jamie surviving until the final act, where she was ultimately killed by her. And the whole cult storyline in the beginning was actually a subplot of the entire film, which also had the entire town of Haddonfield in on it. It just wasn't these people, it was the entire bit of it. He said that there was about 10 drafts that were produced between the start in June and October of 1994. So as you can see, this thing is very messy even before production begins.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So they didn't know what to do with it.
And I mean, it's... Alright, so essentially, by the time it actually comes out, there's two different versions of this film that exist. And there's technically three. The first film is the one that we actually got, the one that we're actually talking about here today. The second one is called The Producer's Cut, and this is one that is a lot darker. It's one that deals a lot more with the cult. It definitely has a lot more of the... a dark gothic noir feel to it. But the final one is actually a director's cut that doesn't it exists on the black market, but doesn't really exist. But what ultimately ends up happening here is the final version that was cut was because the original version of the film, which is now called The Producer's Cut, it was longer, it was darker, and it did really well, really, really poorly at test screenings. So what happened was they went for the final results that came out of that was that it had a brisker pacing and it had a flashier cinematic style to it. So essentially what they did was they added more blood and guts, and according to the writer, he actually said that it ultimately resulted in a little bit more of a confusing movie than the original one. He even went on to go say that the final product is an MTV video rather than a Halloween movie. And I can understand that. Can you see what he's talking about there?
Yeah, that was very MTV 1998.
It currently has a 6% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is being significantly looked at as overwhelmingly disliked. Again, to reiterate, there's actually one of the one, and the producer's copy of it is didn't exist for the longest time. You can now buy it on Blu-ray, but it's weird because I kind of want to watch the producer's cut to see the original cut, because the whole idea of a cult based around Michael Myers, that interests me a little bit more than this.
Sorry, I yawned unexpectedly there.
It's all good.
Yeah, that's not pretty neat. I was confused with all that stuff because it's been years since I've seen the other movies, and I had to sit there and think, wait, what? Okay, yeah. I had to kind of look some stuff up because I always like 1 and 2 a lot, and then the Rob Zombie one, and then like Resurrection H2O was always on TV, so like I've seen those mostly, and then like 4, 5, and 6 never really came on, and 3 would come on some, but I didn't really like it as much because it didn't have anything to do with Michael Myers.
See, like, this brings my point back home, is that you have these films with Jamie Lee Curtis that are so beloved, and then you have these kind of like redheaded stepchilds that nobody likes, nobody wants to talk about. And I actually really enjoy the fourth film. The fifth film was a little bit more not my speed, but the sixth film here, I feel like, gets a lot of bad credit. Give me one sec. I'm actually getting a phone call.
All right, good.
Hello? This is him? I am. Can you guys give me a call back tomorrow? Thank you. It was my publisher.
Your publisher?
Yeah, I'm working on a book right now.
Ooh.
So I'm going to count down and know that this is where I have to edit.
Didn't know you were doing a book.
I am. I'll tell you about it in a few minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, see, like, the fourth film, to me, I feel like kind of gets an unfair rap because it presents an interesting concept. It paces itself well. I really find myself really enjoying it when I go back and watch it. The fifth film is boring, and the sixth film here has a lot of great concepts, but it has its moments, but it's really just feels like it kind of got a little bit too crowded in the kitchen, where they were kind of like, and knowing about all these like different drafts now, it's kind of like they took, this is a cool idea, let's add this, or this is a cool scene, let's add this, and like it just feels very choppy. Now you can kind of see that reflecting, knowing this knowledge. So like, you had watched it just a couple days ago, and it was the first time you had seen it in a while, but like, what was your kind of like initial reaction kind of revisiting this?
Oh, Paul Rudd's came a long way. That's my first thought. I'm always this way with like franchises. Like, I feel like when is enough enough? Like, go ahead and just don't do any more. I don't know. I just felt like they just wanted something to do and just came up with all this jumbo, brought all these characters in, and it was kind of confusing because, like, you know, they added in like the cult stuff at the beginning and kind of led in all that. I mean, I did think it's cool that they gave Tommy like a role as an adult in the movie. Yeah, that was cool. But I don't know. I just feel like it wasn't that necessary, I guess. I don't know.
And I mean, like, that's ultimately what I feel like people kind of feel about this movie as a general whole, because I guess if one thing that I really feel like it's really choppy, and one thing, and I kind of walked away with this film watching again, is like, okay, like the whole like cult is like never really truly explained.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this kind of like subliminal opening where it's probably like 6 to 10 years after the events of part 5, where Jamie Lloyd, who is Laurie Strode's daughter, it like gets impregnated by her uncle. Is like that, like that's what I walked away with like thinking, and I was like, what's the whole point of this? And like they try to explain it, like there is one key moment where they do explain it, but it's never really hit on like later down the line, which is massively disappointing.
Well, I was confused and still am confused on the family that lives in the Myers house. Like, I could have sworn their last names were Stroh too, but were they connected? I had no idea. I tried looking it up and I couldn't find anything like that could help me. And I had no idea.
There's one throwaway line where in the film where Dr. Loomis comes to the house. And it's after he's already visited Tommy. He's kind of come out of retirement. And he goes to the house and he speaks to the wife. And says, you know, tells her about the events that happened. And then she calls her husband. And she's like, you know, the reason that you moved us in here is because your brother could never sell this place. And if you remember from the first film, Laurie Strode's father owned a real estate company called Strode Realty, and you see the sign in the beginning of the house. So the reason that they live there is because the father of that house was the brother to Laurie Strode's father, so they are connected.
Okay, I got you. I was confused because it mentioned someone getting adopted by the Strodes in the movie too, and I was like, who got I thought the whole thing with the baby was like flashbacks and then like showing everything happening in Haddonville, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's like current, but then it wasn't. I was like, what is going on? It was, ugh.
It's one of those films that like it has a lot of good ideas, but not the greatest like delivery, because the idea of just saying, because up to this point, the entire basis for why Michael Myers does what he, like, the entire basis of the majority of the Halloween franchise pings upon the whole, like, aftermath of Laurie Strode and the grief that she goes through in Halloween 2 and in H2O and then finally in Resurrection. Like, that's basically, like, she's really the whole center point of this franchise. And so it's a really interesting idea to say, well, she wasn't the only one. Like, why Tommy was also here. Tommy also experienced this firsthand. How did he turn out? And Paul Rudd, I feel like, for as bad as this film is, like, Paul Rudd really nails it as Tommy. Like, he's just very dry with his humor. He's very, like, he's just very studied and like methodical, and I just felt like he pulled that off really well. And it makes me so sad that we have never actually seen him play a memorable villain, because to me, like, I just feel like he really has the acting chops. Like, even in this film, he really does shine, and it's really impressive that a newcomer really does steal the show from Donald Pleasance.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't know how I felt about Paul Rudd at first. And I'll go ahead and say it, like, I don't dislike Paul Rudd, but I'm not, like, a huge Paul Rudd fan. I don't mind him. But that probably had a little bit to do with, like, me kind of being, like, 50-50 and half about it. But for him being, like, new to, like, the star role and, like, just really, you know, really knew what to expect from him, like, I think he did pull it off pretty well. I mean, at first, I was like, dude, he's creepy sounding. Like, what? And then as the movie went on, I was like, well, he needs to be a little mysterious and weird and kind of nerdy and freaky, because, I mean, he was the kid who experienced all that stuff firsthand that went on. So, I mean, like, you know, that would probably have you in a weird movie when you're older, you know?
And so I was kind of curious, like, how they would turn out, because it's a concept that they have explored more in the comics with the Halloween property, but this is really kind of like the more like mainstream version that we know of how Tommy was. And like, Tommy, to me, I feel like it's really creepy that he just stayed right across the street and just watches that room and like has like all this like research that's like done it. And like, the one thing that I do have about like about his character is I was doing some research, and actually in one of the first like theatrical trailers for this, he's actually a part of the cult, but they cut that storyline out. Like, tell me how much cooler that would have been. And like, it explains how he knows so much about the cult, because there's that scene where he's taking the stroke girl up to his room for the first time, and he's explaining who Michael Myers is and why he is what he is. And then like, he's kind of also like talking about like the cult, but also this symbol that appears. And like, I was like, man, I was like, that's really interesting. Like, I wish that it, but like, having marketing material with him in the cult, in the black robes, like, it would have been a cool nod to like see that. It would have made the story feel more complete. There's a lot about this story that is very much missing because of too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yep. Man, that's crazy, because he didn't know a lot about that stuff. And but like with the cult, I was confused on the girl's son. Like, I don't recall them like following up on like why he was having weird things too. Like, you know, I thought he was gonna go kill somebody at first.
And they do allude to that, but again, it's one of those things that it's like. Like the original writer says, like it's one of those things that like the final result is just so confusing when you're watching it. Like, don't get me wrong, like there, Halloween 6 to me is like one of those movies that's so bad to me that it's enjoyable. Like, I've seen it several times. I willingly watch it several times, and it does have a cult following based around it, mostly the producer's cut. But to me, I enjoy this film for whatever reason. I don't know why. It's an enjoyable film to me. It's not a good film, but it's still enjoyable. It's still a fun film that I love to toss on and just kind of get to see. But like, that is something that they never kind of explore with like the whole kid and like the, I mean, they kind of do that, but they kind of don't. Like, they're talking about essentially like why Michael wants to kill the child is because like essentially like they're gonna raise like the Antichrist, or like gonna raise like a different version of like Michael. Like, his lineage is gonna be passed on through this child, but like the reason that like her son is the way that he is, maybe it has something to do with like the quote-unquote evil or like aroma that's in the house. And it's weird. Like, it's stuff that they try to explain in passing but never fully explain.
Yeah, they definitely lost me. Like, I was like, what in the world? Oh, I didn't even know what Thorn was halfway through the movie. Like, I was like, what is Thorn? What is...
and like, that's one thing that I will say, that's one thing I do appreciate about these four films, is that it feels like a cohesive story. Like, from 4 all the way up until 6, it feels like one cohesive, long-agated story being told through a series of trilogies, which is ironically what a trilogy should be. It should be one long story that you are following over a course of time. And the Dark Knight trilogy embodies that perfectly. So does this 4-6 trilogy. Here, it's one of those things that if you haven't seen 4 and 5 in a long time, and you see the things of like the Curse of Thorn, like, you're not gonna understand that, because it's something that's introduced in the 5th movie, and they kind of explain a little bit of it here. But they're expecting the audience to know, okay, this is a plot line from the 5th movie that we're unveiling for the 6th film.
I need to go back and watch all these. I have a plan for Halloween, but that's a different story. But I do want to watch all these this Halloween, though.
I mean, again, like, I've been going through them slowly, and like, I've some of them I really enjoy going back and watching them. Some of them it is like a power struggle to get through them. But I will again, I say that like there's a lot that this film handles correctly. There's a lot that this film handles incorrectly. And just the kind of unevenness in its storytelling is something that I don't know. Like I kind of, you know, wouldn't want to see. So like Dr. Loomis is like a big part of this franchise. And he's kind of like the linchpin that connects all of these films, because, you know, Laurie Strode is like in mention and the trilogy is kind of passed off to Jamie Lloyd. But like when we meet him in this film, he's kind of like in retirement. So like, do you think that like his like in retirement thing, like it works for this film, or do you think that he could have just stayed like retired? Like, did he have to come out of retirement for this?
Well, I mean, they needed somebody who knew what was going on, but I think, you know, he was needed. But if they didn't want to go with that, Tommy pretty much knew everything.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there was no real reason to bring Loomis into this. I mean, like, he doesn't really serve the story a lot of purpose outside of kind of, like, telling the wife, Mrs. Strode, about the house and the murders. Like, that's about the only purpose I feel like she serves, because as the film kind of progresses and like gets to like the core of its climax, like it's essentially, you essentially have Tommy's character, the chick and the son, and Michael.
Well, I think if they were going to have Loomis come in and do that with the mom, like maybe he could have just been like taking like an evening walk down the block or something and happened to see her outside and like, ma'am, like, you don't know who I am, but do you know about this house? And kind of just one of those one-off things, you know, kind of, he's a passerby and he just happens to feel some kind of evil spirit upon him about what's going to happen on Halloween night and, like, he needed a warner, you know. So maybe that instead of bringing him into the whole movie, I feel like. I don't know.
Like that's a great sequence with him. Like, the very few that we kind of get. And, like, well, I don't know. Because, like, he does serve a little bit into, like, the twist at the end with, like, who's leading the cult. And, like, what did you kind of think of that twist at the end where it was, like, the leader of the cult was actually, like, spoiler alert, but it was actually Loomis's colleague that convinced him to come back into this business?
Yeah. Oh, well, when that dude first got introduced in the movie, I knew that dude wasn't really going to turn out to be who he thought he was. But,
really?
Yeah. I just had this thing. I don't know. So this thing about me, I just saw a movie recently that same thing. The person that ended up being responsible for everything was someone who you wouldn't think it, but I, for some reason, thought that that person has a lot to do with the situation. So I'm not going to give the movie away what it was on here. But it didn't really shock me too much because, like I said, I had that suspicion. And the dude was just like, he kind of just had that aura around him. He's kind of cocky and kind of like, you know, like, oh, yeah, man, you know, just let's do this. Like, he's very confident in what was going on. So I had a feeling he knew more than what was being led.
I hadn't seen this film for like almost like 10 years.
Yeah, same.
Prep for this. So like, I had forgotten a lot of like what this story was about. Like, I had a lot of fond memories of it. But I didn't honestly know or remember a lot of it. So like, going back and rewatching it this past time, I was kind of like, interesting. Like, that's a cool twist. Like, you know, for this, you know, somewhat muddled movie, I'll give them that. Like, to me, I thought the twist was, I didn't see it coming. It took me by surprise. And I was like, again, why are we not getting more with the cult? Like, I feel like that was kind of like my biggest like gripe about this movie is that like you have a cool concept with like this cult of Michael Myers that was previously like teased at in the fifth movie, but you just never really did anything with it in this film. And like Michael's always been about family and just kind of like trying to go after his bloodline. Like that's always been a driving force for him. And so it was nice to kind of see something different, but in the same, but it was also kind of in the same vein. So like having Loomis here was like a love-hate relationship, because like he introduced us to the main antagonist of the film, but at the same time, like he also kind of didn't serve a real purpose that Tommy couldn't have done.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that that conversation, if the conversation with Mrs. Loomis, or not Mrs. Loomis, Mrs. Strode, would have been with Tommy telling her about what happened in the house, do you think it would have been as impactful as having Sam Loomis do it?
No, she probably thought he was some like young college kid on drugs, honestly.
That's fair.
Like, she's like, wait, are you high? Like, what was wrong with you? Get out of my house, you know? Or he's here to see her daughter. That's probably what she might think too. Like, but yeah, I think she would just think he was some of this crazy kid just being crazy, messing up on something.
Fair enough. And so we also had this weird celebration downtown. So like, I think it's really cool too. Like another thing that this film explores is like the whole, like how Haddonfield has kind of progressed post Michael Myers, where they really don't celebrate Halloween anymore. Like Halloween is kind of like this cursed holiday to celebrate. Like no one really wants to talk about it or celebrate it anymore. And college kids in town are like, you know what? We don't believe in this. Like this was our parents' generation. We're bringing back Halloween for the first time, and I think it was like 20 some years. Like, what did you kind of think of how they handled that plot line?
I definitely found it as one of those, like, you know, this is our generation now. We're doing our thing. Let's do it. I thought it was pretty cool because it's like, you know, all that stuff happened. Let's just forget about it. This is the now. We're untouchable. We're the young generation. I am disappointed that we didn't actually get the radio dude to go to the house. I thought it'd been really cool to have a pretty good bit of scenes where like the radio broadcast is actually like broadcasting the dude and some the fans and people in the house, like running around the house trying to hide from Michael Myers, and like just all this. It was been cool to have like him like just toying with all the people like there for the radio broadcast and everything. But I mean, that dude obviously didn't make it that far.
That would have actually been really cool to kind of get some scenes with that concept in there. But then they looked at that one little scene, they were like, what's cooler than radio? Video. Let's make a whole movie about it. We'll call it Halloween Resurrection.
And we'll get the goat in it named Busta Rhymes.
Throw some Tyra Banks in here and some...
Oh, yeah.
Michael, or... what? I can't even remember the kid's name. But he like did like Ryan Merriman. He did a whole bunch of like these Disney Channel movies and then randomly showed up in Halloween. I was like, okay then.
Disney Channel movies. I know somebody who is a big fan and knows Robbie Amell from Disney Channel movies, but had no idea who Stephen Amell was in the story.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, what a song.
And on that note,
yeah, move on.
So Halloween, Curse of Michael Myers. Do you have anything that you want to add or talk about before we close it out?
this is random, but I really enjoyed the closing track and the credits. It was some unknown band, but I thought it was a cool song. Don't really have much to say about it. It was cool to watch it because, like I said, like those Halloween, this movie is a franchise that I've always enjoyed. So anytime I get a chance to watch a movie, even if it's a bad one, I'm still gonna, you know, make the best of it and make myself laugh at all the dumb stuff in it. But you know, but no, man, that's all I got for Curse of Michael Myers.
So, like, I enjoy, and it's actually the title for the film. Fun fact that I learned today: it was, they were trying to find a title for what to call this film, and the writer had actually suggested, why not call it The Curse of Michael Myers, since this production has been cursed. And wow, it just stuck.
Well, I can definitely say, I know this is kind of jumping ahead, but I'm totally excited for the new movie, and I have all plans to watch them all before I see the new one. So, I actually found something at Walmart yesterday. It's this big pumpkin you can buy full of name brand candy for $20. And then you want to buy it, eat the whole thing, and watch horror movies on Halloween night.
Ooh, probably a good time. I'm super excited for Halloween. And it just recently premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival and pretty much got like a standing ovation. Like, I've heard next to nothing bad about this film. Heard that there's a couple of things with it. I've heard that it's super funny. The kills in this are really great. The acting in it's super solid. The writing in it, the direction, the musical score, everything about this film is near perfect. I think the lowest score that I've seen for it is like an 8.5. So I'm really excited for this film, to say the least about it. And this film, Curse of Michael Myers, it'll always be a guilty pleasure for me. I love coming back to this film. Paul Rudd's first film and Michael Myers in the 90s. You mentioned the soundtrack, the ending credits. The soundtrack to this is actually it makes itself feel like an MTV movie.
Oh yeah. Definitely does. You mentioned that this has been a guilty pleasure for you. Resurrection is guilty pleasure for me because it started with, I found out about it through wrestling, and then I watched it because of Busta Rhymes in The Rock cutting the promo on it. So it's like, that's like a guilty pleasure. If I see it on, I'm like, I'm going to watch this, and I'm going to love it because it's so bad.
Yeah, I feel like Halloween's a perfect franchise to kind of have a little bit of those because, like, they're not these, like, nothing in the Halloween franchise is as good as the original, but there are still, like, guilty pleasures or some hidden gems out there. Like, I will still to this day say that the fourth film in the franchise is a hidden gem for me because it is very much set in the pacing of the first film. It kind of moves the plot forward for this universe, this mythology, and it's a really well done, really well acted film. I mean, it's not the bestly written, but for what it is, like, it's a good film.
Yeah, I like what you said about, like, those franchises need those movies that are, like, not great guilty pleasures. Like, for me, going, not really leaving the slasher genre, but I shamelessly love Jason X, and that's all I'm going to tell you.
Maybe one day we'll do Jason X, because I have never seen Jason X all the way through. I've seen bits and pieces of it.
It's so bad it's good. That'd be a fun episode.
All right. Well, if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day, and for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides attempted right here in our own backyard each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can go to facebook.com/PSMidnightCast, or you guys can just reach out to us. We would love to be a bridge to connect you guys with a church or a counselor. You guys can call the Suicide Lifeline 1-800-273-8255. Or you can also text anonymously to 741-741. Or you can also check out our parent site, victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can find even more resources. But my dude, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at BrandonPSMC, Instagram, Changing of Times. Pretty soon I'll be jumping back into Fight Booth, but I'll be doing different things than just covering wrestling show every week. So I'll give you more info on that, because I used to plug Fight Booth a lot when I was in it heavily. So, but yeah, Instagram, Twitter. How about you, Captain?
You guys can find me everywhere under the Victims and Villains banner, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and iTunes. And if you guys want to see some behind the scenes action as well, you guys can also add me on Snapchat at Captain Nostalgia. We'll be back next time shooting for gold as we talk about NBA drafts. And you want to talk about this, because I don't even know when we're covered. It's the NBA draft, but I don't know, like, specifically.
2003 NBA draft.
Okay.
The draft where you saw LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh. And we're going to go through like the draft and the significance of each player and what they've done in their career. It's going to be a good episode if you love NBA and love nostalgia and love the movie Like Mike, because it will be brought up in this movie. Or in this episode.
I liked that movie, Like Mike.
Well, it was a precursor to my love for basketball, but I'll share that. I will save that for our episode with that. So be ready for that. That was just a little, like, teaser for the episode.
All right. So until next time, remember to keep chasing that nostalgia.
Do it.